the result of all the processes that began in 74. The day he saw flowers overwhelm a tyranny. The Algarve stumbled from the sealed-off silence of the dictatorship into a head-banging 24/7 beach party. The southern shores of Portugal are dreamscapes of yellow sand, yellow sun, and blue waters, but they were effectively shut away from the world's tourists by the old regime for 50 years. By the 1980s, however, tourists from across Europe were cooking themselves by day and downing vodka by night on its shores. João was a family doctor by then, and he saw that for a few months of the year, all the locals made pillows of cash and joyfully joined in the sozzled international conga line of tourists, making it the high season in every sense. Then the tourists would go home, and the Algarve would be left empty and jobless. It created a bipolar region, where collective mania was followed by collective depression. "Of course, I saw many people using ecstasy, cocaine and so on, party drugs, but the big problems of addiction," he explained, "were through heroin." It was by trying to solve this problem that João may have stumbled onto another part of the solution to drug prohibition. This is his story, as it was told to me in 2013 by João himself, his colleagues in the Portuguese drug treatment sector, several addicts he has treated, and the news reports about him. Portugal had, by the 1980s, one of the worst heroin addiction problems in the world. One day, a young musician and poet named Victor came to João's office. "He was a very intelligent guy," João recalls. "Very sensitive, and we had big discussions." The young man believed that drugs unleashed his potential to create art. João disagreed. And over time, in the midst of this great national spike in heroin use, he successfully persuaded Victor to lay down the needle, and he watched him achieve a wonderful recovery that served as an example to the people around him. And then, 2 years later, Victor came back to João with a mysterious illness. He died at the age of 23.
"It was very tragic," João tells me. "Yesterday, his mother called me just to wish me a good season. Every year, before Christmas, his mother calls me, and she starts crying."
Portugal had virtually no experience with these drugs before this. The 1960s were cancelled here by the dictatorship, so the country was starting with a blank slate on drug policy. While the use of drugs like cannabis and cocaine was low by international standards, the use of heroin was off the charts and rising. The government was desperate to respond, and the international prohibitionists' playbook was waiting for them. It offered a clear recipe: criminalization, crackdowns, punishment. Portugal adopted it all enthusiastically. But to their puzzlement, the problem just kept getting worse. João was seeing more and more heroin addicts in his practice, and more AIDS cases.
"Heroin use started among marginalized people, but then it came to middle classes and even high classes," he says. "At that time, it was almost impossible to find one Portuguese family that had no problems inside the family or in the close neighborhood."
By the early 1990s, fully 1 in 100 people in the country were addicted to smack. People were scared to come forward for help, even when medical services were offered. Often, addicts stumbled into João's clinic in a desperate state, but refused to give their last names or any contact information. They knew there was a war on, and they were the enemy.
"We were out of options,"
João told one journalist about this period.
"We were spending millions and getting nowhere."
So He set up the first drug treatment center in the Algarve's history, based on the belief that addicts need help, not contempt. His teams treated hundreds of patients, and they began to observe what works and what doesn't. So, in 1997, he was put in charge of the treatment of addicts for the whole country, and in 1999 he was asked by the government to serve on an independent commission made up of 9 doctors and judges, with an impartial academic researcher as the chair, to draw up a comprehensive plan to really deal with the drug problem. They had free rein to think this problem through, starting from scratch. This meant they could acknowledge some fairly obvious facts that had long been ignored in most countries. The first was that the overwhelming majority of adult drug users had no problem. They used for pleasure and did not become addicts. The authorities, they decided, need not concern themselves with these people except to offer safety advice. The second point was that when it came to addicts, the country had already tried, Jval says, the terroristic approach pioneered by Anslinger. Threaten drug addicts and impose severe pain on them if they continue. In his experience at his clinic, this was the best way to make them wish to keep using drugs. To deal with it by chaining, by humiliating, it's the best way to make them angry with the system. To not to wish to be normal. They wanted instead to look at the problem in a more sophisticated way. Joao had seen from all his patients that the addicted person is always divided between the desire to use drugs and the desire to stop. Yet the prohibitionist system keeps kicking the recovering addict back to the ground, making it harder for the part of him that wants to walk away from the drugs. It was very frustrating, he says, to see a patient fight really hard to get clean, only to hear him say, what kind of life am I going to have now? I am unprepared. I have no place to go. So he and his colleagues proposed to build a system based on a radically different notion. They should offer addicts the possibility of having a new life, and give them pleasure instead of pain. His goal, as a doctor, was always trying to identify what happened in the past of an addict that made them find everyday life unbearable, and to help them overcome it by offering compassion and helping them to build a good life as an alternative. Now they were asking, if this is the goal of all good doctors, why can't it be the goal of government policy? So when the panel reported, it made recommendations based on these insights. It said that drug users should be treated as full members of society instead of cast out as criminals or other pariahs. Instead of striving toward an unachievable perfection such as zero drug use, they would decriminalize all drugs. Choosing to put a chemical into your body should not be a crime, and being addicted should not be a crime. Instead, all the money spent on arresting, trying, and punishing addicts should be transferred to educating kids and helping addicts to recover. To the astonishment of many people, the Portuguese Parliament debated it thoroughly. There was a very senior figure in the government who had a brother addicted to heroin. João took him to visit many places across Europe where drug addicts were treated less cruelly. That politician became one of the great champions of this new approach. The sheer scale of the problem in Portugal meant that it was easier to persuade the public than many people had expected. As Joao says, the feeling that a drug addict is a sick person rather than a criminal was already present in the society. People knew, well, my son is a good guy, but he's not a criminal. He's someone who needs help. So in 2001, in Portugal, the persecution of drug users and addicts officially ended. The new law stipulated that recreational drug users should, above all, not be labelled or marginalised, and addicts should be approached by the state exclusively to encourage him or her to seek treatment. It was no longer a crime to possess enough drugs for 10 days' personal use. It's important to understand that while it was no longer illegal to use and possess drugs, it was not legal to sell them. To legalize and regulate their sale would have required Portugal to become the first country ever to renounce the UN conventions authored by Anslinger. That is a step that could have triggered sanctions and crackdowns from other countries. This meant that the control of the drug trade was still in the hands of armed criminal gangs, but the panel and the parliament felt they were being as bold as they could. No other country had gone this far since the start of drug prohibition. There were widespread predictions from parts of the Portuguese right and across the world that this would trigger a catastrophe. The chief of the Lisbon drug squad, João Figueira, believed there would be an explosion of consumption where lots of people start consuming, and then we lose control of the situation. In the writings of prohibitionists everywhere at this time, there was a clear tone of, just you wait and see. In his office, Gulao told me there were two dimensions to Portugal's drug revolution. The panel didn't simply lift the legal penalties and leave people to it. They took the big, lumbering machinery of the drug war and turned it into an equally big, active machine to establish a drug peace.
The big effect of decriminalization, he said, was to make it possible to develop all the other policies.
In the United States, 90% of the money spent on drug policy goes to policing and punishment, with 10% going to treatment and prevention. In Portugal, the ratio is the exact opposite. Back on Chino's block in Brownsville, Brooklyn, the state spends $1 million for every 5 people it arrests and convicts of mid-level drug offences. That's what it took to get the Souls of Mischief off the streets, for a while. What João did in Portugal was to use all that money in a very different way. He believed that if you removed the stigma and shame caused by making addiction a crime, it would be possible to invite addicts into a welcoming web of care and treatment and support. I wanted that to be true. But was it? Opposite a Santander bank, on an overcast day, I find a bare, unmarked building, and in one of its hallways, a 17-year-old boy with spiky hair, swaddled in a big parka, is waiting. He has just been interviewed by a psychologist for an hour, and now Nuno Capaz, a tall sociologist in his mid-30s, is calling him into a small conference room. The system built by João and his colleagues had a distinction at its heart between the 90% of drug users who have no problem and should be left alone and the 10% who are addicts and need help. They had to figure out a mechanism to sift the addicts from the users. This small room and the dozens like it across the country is the solution. It is called the Dissuasion Commission. The police don't go looking for drug users anymore, but if they stumble across you, they will write you a ticket that requires you to come here the next day. The job of the Dissuasion Commission is only to figure out whether you have a drug problem. You can be honest with them because nothing you say or do here will ever get you a criminal record. If the interview with the psychologist in the next room reveals that you are a drug user who doesn't have a problem, they will bring you in here, warn you about the risks, tell you how to make your use as safe as possible, don't use alone, for example, in case you have a bad reaction, and send you on your way. Nuno, who oversees the informal hearings, stresses that the vast majority of the people he sees here are using drugs just because they like it. They do not have a problem with it, they just do it because it makes them feel good.
In those cases, they don't actually need treatment or imprisonment. They might eventually need to be careful, but they don't need a medical doctor or a jailer or a legal intervention.
He tells me, for example, about a typical guy who worked in a bar and used cocaine on the first Saturday of every month without fail, and never on any other day. He loved it, and because he loved it, he knew he had to restrict his use tightly, so he was able to resist temptation the rest of the time.
Nuno tells him, "Be careful, stick with it, just do it once a month, in the company of some people who are not doing it, because you might have a seizure."
This kind of advice is the end of your contact with the state for 9 out of 10 people. I watch as Nuno has a 20-minute conversation with the teenage boy in his parka, who was found smoking cannabis on the street. Nuno explains that it's bad for your memory and concentration, and that you need both to do well in your studies. The boy agrees, asks for some literature that explains more, and leaves. That's it.
"In a lot of cases of underage people," Nuno tells me, once the boy is gone, "what we do is try to reduce the anxiety of the parents. Because the kid was caught with 0.3 grams of hashish, we have parents going, 'He's going to be a drug addict. He's going to ruin the family.' We say, 'Let's calm down a bit.' In the majority of cases, he will eventually quit using hashish, and he will not use anything else or have any psychological and physical problems from it. So let's not make a big deal. Especially with minors, we have to work more on the parents than on the kid, because the kid is much more well-informed than the parents."
Nuno continues,
"Unless you are very, very unlucky, or unless you are trying to be caught,
as a non-problematic user, you won't come back to the Dissuasion Commission, because the police will not stop you in the street out of nowhere and say, 'Let me see what you have in your pockets.'
The drug users get picked up only when they are using blatantly in public, or when the drugs are found by chance, like in a search of suspects after a street fight. 'It'll be very difficult,' he says, 'for you to get caught. Twice. If you are, though, the commission can level small fines. 80 euros is the norm, making it the most expensive joint the guy ever had. But you could say it's a fairly symbolic thing,"
Nuno says. "If, however, the interview reveals that you are using your drugs dangerously, by, say, sharing needles, they will direct you toward the needle exchanges and other places that will make you safer from disease and death. When it comes to the 10% who are addicts, Nuno's job is to offer information without judgment, and ferry you towards the services that are there to keep you alive and get you well. We can't oblige anyone to do anything when it comes to treatment," he says. "But when they are ready for help, it is there right away. If the person shows up at 10 o'clock in the morning," he says, "we can schedule them for 1 o'clock in the afternoon at the treatment facility in order for them to start the analysis." From Nuno's office, any addict who wants to stop will be booked for free into the Taipash Treatment Center. It is at the edge of a large pink hospital on yet another hill. 6 addicts are lying on a mat in a gym, being gently massaged. Some have their eyes closed, some are looking sideways, with a little smile. These massages help them to cope with the withdrawal pains, one of the nurses tells me, but it has a more important function. It helps them learn how to calm down without a chemical cocktail, often for the first time. The program here, I am told, is built on João's belief that using drugs is only a symptom of some suffering, and we have to reach the reasons that make addicts want to be out of their heads much of the time.
"You can stop using drugs for a while, but if you don't solve the problems you have in your mind, things will come back. We have to work on the trauma in your life, and only then can you change the way you deal with it.
So this institution is here, as he puts it, to help addicts
to increase their insight, to analyze themselves, helping them to understand themselves and the way they react.
Over your year and a half being treated here for addiction, the team will try to build a safe, trusting environment where you can do something you have been running away from for years. Express your emotions and tell your story truthfully. This often starts with basic steps. The recovering addicts play a game based on Pictionary, where they have to make a face that expresses an emotion, such as anger or sadness. At first, many of them refuse. It's too frightening. They can't bear to let these emotions show, even in a game, for a moment. This is one reason why they have needed to be intoxicated for so long, to escape the terror and lack of control that comes with emotions like these. In another game, they have to let themselves fall backward, knowing the group behind them will catch them as they fall. The addicts find this inconceivable, and they often refuse. They can't trust anyone. But slowly, over time, they learn here that these emotions can be explored without the need to be chemically numbed. To Joao, this is what recovery means. I watched them playing these childlike games, trying to learn how to feel. And I think of the women I left behind at Tent City and in prisons across the United States who are learning nothing except how to cut off their feelings. I tried to picture Chino's mother here, learning to figure out how she feels at last. But this is, I was going to discover, only the first layer of support for addicts in Portugal, and not the most important. João believes that addiction is an expression of despair, and the best way to deal with despair is to offer a better life, where the addict doesn't feel the need to anesthetize herself anymore. Giving rewards, rather than making threats, is the path out. Congratulate them, give them options, help them build a life. That was his reasoning behind the second and most important phase of treatment for addicts in Portugal. Once you take those first courageous steps to Taipas, or a centre like it, the government will prioritise getting you a job with a decent wage, away from the world where you used drugs.
They want to be a part of the society, he tells me. We can't tell them to behave as a normal citizen and deprive them of a role in society. Having a job, having work, having a salary.
His aim is to give them something to lose. So the government gives a hefty year-long tax break to anyone who employs a recovering addict. Almost always, when the year is up, the employer keeps the former addict on in his garage or bakery or shop because she has turned out to be a good worker. The last time João moved with his family, he hired a moving company that was established with the help of his department. 10 recovering addicts came together to form a cooperative, and the state lent them the money to buy a truck at a very low interest rate. His wife had been nervous, but the guys did a perfect job, João says with pride. Of course, he adds, in that cooperative of 10,
some of them will relapse. But now, the others are protectors. They will help to deal with that problem. They will insist, go to your doctor, go now, as soon as possible. Try to stop again, then you can work with us again. They as a group protect themselves.
This, it occurs to me after we speak, is the precise opposite of the prohibitionist approach. In the drug war, we guarantee addicts will find it almost impossible to work again, by marking them with the scarlet letter of a criminal record. After the drug war, we will make it easier to employ recovering addicts with subsidies, because we understand this will keep them from relapsing more effectively than the threat of being caged. If, however, you are not ready to move away from using drugs, you will be given a different kind of support. On a misty Friday morning, I took the subway to a housing project on the edge of Lisbon. The apartments were even more cramped than in the rest of the city, piled on top of each other with brightly coloured bricks, like some dystopian Lego model. A large graffitied mural of a rapper I didn't recognise stared at me, as did several women who were hanging out their underwear from the 10th-floor windows. A wispy fog was hanging over the place, so I had to focus hard to see the street names. They were stern. I realized I was wandering along the Avenida Ciudad de Bratislava. At the bottom of the housing project, by a busy road, the mist was clearing, and I could see a plain white van with an open window and a short line of men and women standing in the line, chatting beside it. The small white cups they were handed contained methadone. They swallowed it, and then talked to the psychologists and doctors standing there, listening sympathetically. Then they left and got on with their day. João had told me back in his office that with this drug, you don't feel high, but you remain with no suffering for the lack of heroin. So you are completely available to work, to study, or whatever. Even to drive a truck. We have several truck drivers on methadone. I stood with the social workers and listened to their conversations. Their goals were, it quickly became clear, more modest than those of the Taipash Treatment Centre. These were the addicts who believed they were not ready to stop, and who were at serious risk of dying of an overdose or of a disease transmitted by dirty needles. Nuno Biscaya, a psychologist in his mid-30s, clearly knew everybody who came here by name, after years of befriending them. I talked to him for hours as the sun came out. A good day at work for him, he said, was when he could persuade one of the addicts he worked with to move from injecting heroin to smoking heroin. I looked at the line of addicts. A tall young man who speaks three languages. A defeated-looking woman in her 40s. An angry guy who pulls up on a motorcycle and doesn't want to talk. And wondered how many of them would stay alive if this service was shut down. Some people argue that you didn't have to decriminalize drugs in Portugal to expand treatment in this way. You could have more treatment and criminalization. It was only standing here, in this line of addicts, that the flaw in this argument became clear to me. These Portuguese addicts were standing in a long line, in public, in front of their friends and neighbors and employers. A police car drove past as they were being served. Nobody tensed, or even seemed to notice. Except me. Would they come forward every morning before everyone to declare themselves criminals? A few days later, I went out with another team, whose job was to get help to the hardest-to-reach addicts, the people who live on the streets or in abandoned housing. As we walked through ragged half-houses made of rubble and the battered housing projects, these social workers told me that before João's drug revolution, people ran from them. Now they run toward them. Addicts come forward to replace their needles, to chat, to say they are thinking about asking for help. Their reactions were so different from those I had learned under Prohibition, I kept being thrown off by them. Can't you see these are the authorities? Run! I wanted to understand the long-term effects of this approach on individuals, and in Portugal's second-largest city, Oporto, I met a man who seemed to epitomize them. Sergio Rodriguez was sleeping in an abandoned roofless house with only the sky above him in the last days of Portugal's drug war when he was suddenly woken up. He was being kicked, hard, again and again, all over his body. He knew what was happening. All the street addicts in Portugal knew what this was. It's the police, and they are beating him up. For sport. For fun. Because this is a war, and addicts are the enemy. Get out of here, they snarled. Sergio had been an addict for 11 years. He shot up heroin and cocaine 5, 10, 20 times a day, however much he could afford, to nuke as much of his consciousness as he could. He had grown up in one of the poorest parts of the city of Oporto, in claustrophobic concrete streets that are a strange mashup of 16th-century buildings and 21st-century criminality. In his neighborhood, everybody his age that he knew stood on ancient European cobbles to sell or snort cut Colombian cocaine. All his brothers were street addicts. He was 16 when he started, and he didn't see when it would end, but he suspected it would be soon. His friends on the street were dying all around him. Some days he would ask where a friend was because he hadn't seen him in a while, but in his heart he would know. Except, because João had changed the law, a very different group of people was coming to look for Sergio. João and his panel knew that somebody like Sergio, cut off from society and terrified of the authorities, after a generation of the drug war, would be hard to reach. So, as part of their policy revolution, they put in place another way to help him. They employed street teams of psychologists to fan out across the country to look in all the old ruined houses and broken crannies where the most hardcore addicts live, and to offer them help. At first, these teams approached modestly, offering clean needles and collecting the dirty ones. Over time, in these exchanges, as they struck up conversations, they formed relationships. They gave advice on where you should inject yourself to stay as safe as possible, and on how to avoid disease. Then, discreetly, they started to explain that there was a way out, if you wanted it. Sometimes they were only planting a seed that would take years to grow. Sometimes people wanted help, fast. Now that the punishments were gone, people like Sergio were, tentatively, starting to listen. The face of authority was changing. Where once there were police with batons to beat you, there are now psychologists offering help. It was a street team that persuaded Sergio to try a treatment center for rehab, so he could become abstinent. He went. He tried. But it didn't work. He couldn't stay off heroin. When that shoe didn't fit, the street team didn't write him off as a failure. They tried another shoe to see if it fit better. They got him into a longer-term program called a therapeutic community, where he lived for 1.5 years, regularly saw a psychologist, and was given the substitute drug methadone every day. Sergio got a job. He got into a relationship. His girlfriend got pregnant. And as his bonds with the world around him grew stronger, his bonds with his drug began to weaken and wither. So he decided to stop the methadone. Now he uses only cannabis or cocaine, very occasionally, at parties. "My life has changed completely," he said, when I met him in a shishi cafe in Oporto, with a piano player tinkling in the corner and a sycophantic waiter bowing at our every request. He looked no different from the other customers. He paid taxes, and he beamed when he talked about his excitement at how he was about to become a dad. As we sat together, I couldn't help thinking that in the countries where the drug war was still being waged, he would be regarded, even now, as a criminal and a failure. We walked out onto the cobbled streets where once he had slept, broken and filthy, and Sergio waved goodbye as he walked back to a life made possible by the end of the drug war. Yes, I kept thinking, things are better for addicts. I expected that. But what about for kids? I am very close to my nephews and my niece. This book is dedicated to them. And for all the horrors of the drug war, my biggest worry about ending it has always been that more kids might end up using drugs. This would damage them in all sorts of ways. But here's just one. There is strong scientific evidence that persistent cannabis use affects how adolescent and teenage brains develop and can permanently lower their IQ. One of my best friends, when I was a kid, smoked a lot of weed, and he feels it harmed him for life. Developing brains are more fragile than adult brains. They need to be protected. In a classroom full of Portuguese 16-year-olds at the Romeu Correa High School, we are watching as a girl named Sabrina is offered her first taste of cocaine. She is tall and lean and gorgeous, and she wants to be a supermodel. The man offering the white powder is in his 20s, handsome and seductive. The class is discussing what she should do. Should she go with him? Should she snort it? These are the children of the drug revolution. They were 5 years old when all drugs were decriminalized, so they have never known the drug war. For many people of my generation, growing up in the 1980s, drug education consisted mainly of being told that if you tried drugs, your life would be ruined, and that was that. As soon as you smoked your first spliff and survived, you dismissed your teachers as liars on the issue of drugs, and you stopped listening, even to the parts you needed to hear. As Portugal changed its drug laws, it was also in the process of abandoning just-say-no prevention programs and replacing them with something radically different. The teacher, Luche Bayou, explains to these kids that they can discuss their thoughts about what Sabrina should do candidly, since what they are talking about hasn't been a criminal offense any time they can remember. They seem to take that for granted. They are staring at the whiteboard, where this scenario has been projected for them to talk about. "It would be very risky to use this drug," one of the kids says, "because it is more addictive than the marijuana he has tried a few times at parties with his friends." "All of life is a risk," another boy says, rebutting him. "Yes," a girl replies, "but that's no reason to take risks unnecessarily." The class giggles a little at the subject matter, but they seem engaged. This is clearly a conversation that takes place between teenagers everywhere. I can remember how we would have it when I was that age, on buses, in the park, at parties. But we were alone, with only our own ignorance to reflect back at each other. Luche mediates neutrally. She listens. She doesn't ever look judgmental or shocked. So when she refers to the real risks involved in taking this drug, the kids seem to listen, precisely because she's not pretending it's the whole picture. After a debate, the class reaches the conclusion that Sabrina would be foolish to use the cocaine, and they vote for her to say no. They reach this conclusion on their own. They are not, I think, trying to please their teacher. They are expressing their own thoughts. The social disapproval of hard drugs didn't die with the old drug laws. Indeed, it may be stronger now, since there's no rebellion in drug use anymore. This approach brings teenage decisions into discussion with the adult world, instead of pretending they don't exist. In Portugal, the dilemmas of teenage life aren't playing out in a sealed-off cocoon of adolescence. They play out in conversation with parents and teachers and the guidance they can offer. After criminalization ends, a new, more candid conversation can begin. It occurs to me, as I watch the students, that the philosophy expressed in these lessons runs through all the reforms in the country since 2001. Prohibition is based on externally preventing people from using drugs through fear and force. The Portuguese alternative is based on the belief that drugs aren't going away, so you need instead to give people the internal tools, the confidence, the knowledge, the support, to make the right decisions for themselves. The school bell rings, and the kids shuffle out of the classroom. They have, I realize, had honest conversations with adults, in place of the boo and hiss pantomime my generation was offered. This is the kind of mature approach liberals have been advocating for years. But there is a strange anxiety in seeing your proposals put into practice. What if they fail? What if we end the drug war and drug use explodes? What if punishing people really does keep large numbers of people sober? What if more people end up, like too many of the people I love, addicted? What if you saw other disasters start to emerge? Ones I can't even predict now. One man, more than any other, issued this warning before Portugal began its drug revolution. His name is João Figueira. He is the chief of the Lisbon Drug Squad, the closest equivalent in Portugal to the head of the DEA, or the chief inspector of Scotland Yard's narcotics division. He is a carefully spoken, mild-mannered man with an enormous moustache of a type unseen outside the pages of late Victorian fiction. He greets me in a dim police station corridor where the yellow fluorescent lighting makes the walls look sickly, and we squeeze into an arthritic elevator to reach his office. His concerns, at the time of decriminalization, spoke for many people in Portugal. As we saw earlier, he warned that once the criminal penalties were lifted, we could have an explosion of consumption, where lots of people start consuming, and then we lose control of the situation. More than anyone else in the country, his men saw the changes on the streets, up close and immediate. It was a fear that, if we are totally candid, some of us in the drug reform movement shared. So João Figueira watched the results happen in real time, very closely, expecting vindication. And he found something else. "The things we were afraid of," he said, "didn't happen." Two highly respected and impartial bodies have studied the outcomes. The European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction, or EMCDDA, and the British Journal of Criminology. They have no horse in this race. Their role is solely to figure out what actually happened. They discovered there has been a slight increase in overall drug use, from 3.4 to 3.7% of the population. But Portugal started with a low rate of use, except for heroin, and it stayed low compared to other countries. The EMCDDA found Portugal is ninth lowest out of 28 European countries when it comes to cannabis use, fifth lowest when it comes to amphetamines, and fifth lowest when it comes to ecstasy. Over a decade after full decriminalization, Portugal has, they found, a level of drug use that is, on the whole, below the European average and much lower than its only European neighbor, Spain. But what about the three forms of drug use that the prohibitionists understandably offer as the reason why we must continue fighting the drug war? Addiction, deaths due to drug use, and teenage drug use. These figures were collected carefully. The Portuguese Ministry of Health says that the number of problematic drug users has literally been halved, from 100,000 to 50,000. The British Journal of Criminology confirms it is down, but found a more modest decline, from 7.6 people per thousand to 6.8, while confirming that injecting drug use has indeed been almost halved, from 3.5 injectors per thousand people to 2. When they compare the situation to the nearby countries of Spain and Italy, which are still waging the drug war, they found that Portugal is the only of these nations to have exhibited declines in problematic drug use. So there are fewer addicts after decriminalization. At the same time, the British Journal of Criminology found that overdose has been reduced significantly, and the proportion of people contracting HIV who get it from drug use has fallen from 52% to 20%. This means that fewer young people like Victor, the musician whom Joao sat in his clinic in the Alcove, having long conversations with, at the birth of this transformation, are getting sick. Figuera thinks he knows why all this has happened. It is, he tells me, because
we don't see a drug addict as a criminal anymore. He's someone that needs help. And everyone thinks it. Then they consider themselves sick people. They don't consider themselves to be against the society. It's a big change.
It means that now they are not marginalized. They are just like a traffic accident. They are not on the other side of the line. They are regular citizens. They have a problem. In the old days, he says, when somebody you knew became an alcoholic, we treated those guys as friends. They needed help, not abuse. He now realizes drug consumers are on exactly the same level. In fact, it is exactly the same situation. It is a sickness that needs to be treated. Now, instead of being hounded to the gutter, they are helped to a hospital. In the years since heroin was decriminalized in Portugal, its use has been halved there, while in the United States, where the drug war continues, it has doubled. But what, I found myself worrying, about teenagers? Are the kids in Lucia's class more or less likely to use drugs than my nephews and nieces? They are the most vulnerable group because an increase in the use there would affect their brain chemistry for the rest of their lives. Children aged 15 to 16 in Portugal also reported one of the lowest lifetime prevalences of cannabis use in Western Europe, 13%, the EMCDDA found, while their level of cocaine use is almost half the EU average. It is slightly down since decriminalization started. In 1999, 2.5% of 16 to 18-year-olds used heroin. By 2005, after 6 years of this model of decriminalization, it was down to 1.8%. I spent a lot of time on the streets walking and arresting consumers, João Figueira says, and he believed in it. So he describes what he sees on the streets now with a tone of mild amazement. He stresses that the new drug policy has brought a transformation, too, in the lives of the people who have never once touched a drug. It was very common, before the end of the drug war, that heroin addicts would rob people to get their next fix, he says. But the crimes related to drug consumption are now finished. It doesn't happen. The crimes on street level related to drug consumption, there aren't any anymore. They are all either on methadone, in treatment, or recovering, so they don't need to rob cars or assault people. He adds, this is a complete change. And this change has caused another transformation in how people see the police. I don't think people in poor neighborhoods see the police now as enemies. I think this is important. This is different. I think of Lee Maddox back in Baltimore, and how she told me this would happen after the end of the drug war. This, in turn, Figuera says, makes investigating all forms of crime easier. We spare lots of resources, human resources, paperwork, money, to go after real criminals. In the past, he spent his time arresting consumers without any result. Now he says, there are results. He is careful to add one caveat. These results are not due to the change in the law alone. The heroin use in the 1980s and 1990s was so widespread and so damaging that it spurred a backlash among young people who looked at their older siblings and resolved never to follow those particular track marks to disaster. So some of these changes would have happened even without the transformation in the drug laws. But not, he is confident, all of it. João Figueira describes himself as very conservative. At first, he says, when the laws were changed, the left wing said, let's do this, and the right wing said, no, no, no. And in fact, on the results we have, there is no kind of ideological debate anymore, because it has nothing to do with ideology. What happened here worked, he explains. What happened here was a good result, and the statistics we have prove it. There is no ideology in this. Now everyone, conservatives or socialists, accepts the situation. Since the drug policy revolution, Portugal has had two governments of the left and two governments of the right. All have kept the decriminalization in place. None of the political parties wants to go back. I felt a sense of physical relief as he spoke, and as I reviewed these figures. It has turned out, it seems, that strengthening people's internal resistance to drugs works a lot better than trying to terrorize them away from drugs with force. The alternative works, and the best proof is that virtually nobody in Portugal is arguing for a return to the old ways. All of the Portuguese society accepts it completely. It is a system that is settled, Figueira says. As I travelled around Portugal, I struck up conversations with people on trains and in cafes and on the streets, and it was startling to me to see how quickly decriminalization had become the common sense of the country. People described the idea of busting users and addicts with puzzlement, as if it were a strange medieval practice from the distant past. A few people argued that the benefits for addicts are too generous, but that is the only criticism I heard. Nobody sees this as a Hollywood ending. Everybody knows addiction continues, and it remains a tragedy, but there is a lot less of it. João Figueira looks at me, and from behind his bushy moustache, he smiles. I was not expecting it, he says, that this would work so well. After I left my meeting with him, I walked the streets of Lisbon for hours, lost in a head rush of optimism, because I saw now, for the first time, how narrow the gap is between even the most passionate prohibitionists and people who want to radically change the laws. Most of the people I've met on this journey who support the drug war are not like Harry Anslinger, driven by racism and hatred and personal inadequacy. They are like João Figueira, admirable people who have a series of understandable worries about the alternative. They support the drug war out of compassion for all the people they fear might become victims if we relax the laws. They are good people. They are acting out of decency. It occurred to me, as I walked up and down those Lisbon streets, that we all, the vast majority of drug warriors and the vast majority of legalizers, have a set of shared values. We all want to protect children from drugs. We all want to keep people from dying as a result of drug use. We all want to reduce addiction. And now the evidence strongly suggests that when we move beyond the drug war, we will be able to achieve those shared goals with much greater success. At the start of my journey, I set out to find an answer to a contradiction within myself and within our culture, between the impulse to be compassionate to addicts and the impulse to crush and destroy our addictive impulses. Now, at last, I see, and really feel, that it is not a contradiction at all. A compassionate approach leads to less addiction. The conflict within me, the one I found so disturbing, is not a conflict at all. It's not a question of one impulse winning over the other. They can both win, if we just do it right. If this insight were more widely understood, I asked myself, how would it change our debate? I think we'd start to see this isn't a debate about values. It's a debate about how to achieve those values. In the United States alone, legalizing drugs would save $41 billion a year currently spent on arresting, trying, and jailing users and sellers, a according to a detailed study by the Cato Institute. If the drugs were then taxed at a similar rate to alcohol and tobacco, they would raise an additional $46.7 billion a year, according to calculations by Professor Jeffrey Myron of the Department of Economics at Harvard University. That's $87.8 billion next year and every year. For that money, you could provide the Portuguese style of treatment and social reconnection for every drug addict in America. I know there are people who say that the United States or Britain or other large countries can't learn from other countries, that Portugal is so small and so different it has nothing to teach a superpower. As João Figueira waved goodbye to me from his police station, where no drug user will ever be busted again, I pictured Lee Maddox, who told me back in Baltimore that this model could save her city, too. I kept walking. That afternoon, as I strolled through the squares of Lisbon, middle-aged men skulked up to me and flashed packets of drugs. You want? They asked insistently. It's important to understand the limits of the Portuguese experiment. They have decriminalized the personal possession, but not the sale, of drugs. This is a strange hybrid. Everyone knows that to possess drugs, you have to buy them. So, under this system, you mostly still have to go to these criminals and their gangs. This means the new Portuguese laws save Marcia Powell and the women in Tent City, but they do not stop Arnold Rothstein or Rosalio Reta or their local affiliates. True, it has dented their business a little, in some ways. When the methadone vans started going out across the country's streets, the drug dealers stoned the vans and smashed up the offices of the health workers because, as João Goulau says, it was the first time there was a decrease in their earnings, in their memories. But they still control the bulk of the trade. Decriminalization can't take it away from them. Only legalization can. The architects of the Portuguese drug revolution believe this will come in time. I asked João Goulau if he was sympathetic to this argument.
Yes, he said, and I believe this is the trend. But I also believe that this trend needs a vast consensus among nations, and I don't believe that the political environment, even here in Europe, is very favorable of such a movement. But it will happen in the future.
Back in the yellow sands of the Algarve in 1996, before the laws were changed, before the treatment was expanded, before the drug war ended, another young addict, the last in this book, was staggering in to see a doctor. Antonio Gago was a stringy and strung-out boy who, at the age of 14, had started coping with the fact he was being abused by his dad by smoking heroin. He was 21, and he knew only that all the local addicts had Dr. João Goulau's personal phone number. He handed it out to anybody he thought might need it. At first, João got Antonio a daily supply of methadone. But, perhaps more important, he listened. He seemed to think Antonio's feelings and thoughts mattered. Even on his days off, he would sometimes meet Antonio and sit with him. One Christmas day, Antonio received a call from João, who was contacting all his addicted patients one by one.
"You're going to get what you want. A new life," he said.
"You can have more honesty with a doctor like this," Antonio told me, years later. "I never felt any kind of condemnation, and that helped me to open up my life and my heart a little more."
He started to talk about the real reasons why he used drugs, the things his father did.
"I had to cover that up with the drugs," he says.
João helped him to get into rehab, and when Antonio came out and sank back into heroin, he wasn't judgmental. He was just there.
When Zhuo was put in charge of the country's drug policy, he started to fund long-term therapeutic communities where addicts can live and be helped to rebuild their lives over a period